You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
I sound relaxed? I'm very relaxed. I am back from my little hiatus. Yes, 1 week off. That's the hiatus we get around here on Lead Singer Syndrome, a podcast that I, your host, Shane Told, brings to you almost every week, where I speak to other lead singers about what it's like to be the front man or front woman of a band. And yes, I had a beautiful holiday. I went down to Jamaica, my first time there. It was absolutely beautiful, absolutely wonderful. All the people there were just so great. Really needed it. The Silverstein record is finished. It was a lot of work. It was a lot of stress. I talked a little bit about it, you know, over the last few intros, you know, of these episodes, but it's done. The record came out great. And now that I've been able to go clear my head a little bit, well, not completely, because I went to Las Vegas and, you know, did the whole thing after too. I mean, come on, this is Lead Singer Syndrome. We don't just go to tropical islands, right? We got to party a little bit too. But now that the record's done, I've had a little time to sit on it, listen back. I am feeling super good about this album. And yeah, I'm really excited for everybody to hear it. And now we just, you know, do all the things you got to do setting up an album. So that should be a lot of fun. This week, we have a great guest, an amazing guest, a guy I've wanted to talk to for a very long time. I'm a huge fan. Greg of the Menzingers is here on the program, and it's his first podcast, apparently. So there's probably a lot here that even if you're a huge fan of the Menzingers, you might not even know, because we get pretty deep about all kinds of things, and it was really, really a terrific episode, which is why I've kept it here, so that the big return of the podcast after my 1 week hiatus, you know, it's going to be a good one. So sit back and get ready for that. Last week, there was an episode of the podcast, but only the members of the All Access Club got to listen to that one. So yeah, if when I take these breaks, it's you're like, oh man, where's that episode? Oh, and you're a little bummed out. Maybe you need to throw me a bone, because you're going to throw yourself a bone as well. You're going to get all these great bonus episodes. You're going to get all this other stuff, merchandise, and an amazing community of people, other fans of the show, access to them, and of course, access to me. And it is called the Lead Singer Syndrome All Access Club. And it costs as little as $6 a month. That gets you all the bonus content and a lot of great stuff, really. And there's higher tiers as well if you want to support the show more and more. And it really is what keeps this thing going every single week, minus last week, which I needed a break. But check it out. The link, leadsingersyndrome.com/All Access. Like I said, only $6 a month. It really, really does help me out. Once again, that link, leadsingersyndrome.com/All Access. Silverstein news, in case you're interested, we are going on a great big tour, and it starts in January, actually. We're starting off in Australia. Lucky us. at the Unified Festival. The Unify Festival. Sorry, I always say Unified because that's the label we're on. The festival is the Unify Gathering Festival. That's what we're playing. It's going to be great. Some great bands like Architects, The Ghost Inside, North Lane. It really is a great lineup. Then we're headed to the Philippines. If you're from there, and I know some listeners, they are from there, check it out. We're playing in Manila. That's going to be awesome. We're playing Hawaii, and then we go over to Europe, celebrating 20 years. Oh my God, we've been a band for 20 years. With three sets, it's going to be really, really awesome. And after Europe, we're doing the US and Canada. Tickets are on sale for all of that stuff right now. Head over to Silverstein20, that's Silverstein20.com, for all your tickets and VIP needs. Well, that's about it for the intro. I missed you guys. I really did. I was on the beach of Jamaica, just closing my eyes, drinking a Red Stripe, being like, man, I should be editing a podcast right now. Wait, I don't have to. I got a whole nother week, but I did think about you guys. So thank you for listening to this thing, and make sure you hit the subscribe button as well, because next week we got another banger. I'll talk to you after this episode. Here it is, my conversation with Greg of the Menzingers. A little Irish in your blood, a little Polish in your name, a little Boston in your attitude, just the way you were raised, 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 just the way you were raised.
Dude, thanks for doing this, man.
Thank you so much for having me. This is awesome. This is actually it's my first podcast.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I've never done one before.
I would have figured like Ray from 100 Words or Less, you'd probably know Ray Harkins, or like one of those people would like have had you on. I mean,
I don't know. You know, it's Tom is typically the podcast guy. Tom does a lot of podcasts, and he has his own podcast. He's really into them. And I don't know. I think that typically when it comes up, I'm always just like, hey, Tom, why don't you do it? You know, I know how much you love him and stuff. So, but I was just like, yeah, why don't I do one?
No, totally. I was talking about having you on the show for like years, though. I think it was
awesome.
I don't know if Tim is still your manager. Tim Zahaji.
He is, yep.
He is, yeah. Oh, I love Tim. He used to manage our band, actually.
Awesome, nice.
Yeah, he's a great guy. And I was talking to him about this like years ago. I think like when I first started the show.
Nice.
I've been a huge fan of you guys. Like, I guess pretty much since it was your third record on The Impossible Past.
Yeah.
I've
always
wanted to just chat with you. So this is really, really cool. It's like years
of amazing. Amazing.
So where are you right now? You're off for a bit, or you got some shows coming up?
So we're about halfway through our tour, and today's a day off, and we're in New Orleans.
Oh, okay. That works.
Yeah, totally.
Do you like New Orleans? I've heard a lot of mixed opinions on the city.
So I absolutely love New Orleans. It's one of my favorite cities, not only in the country, but in the world. My dad lived here in the 90s, and I would spend a lot of time. Me and my brother would come down, and we would hang out for, you know, weeks on end with him. And my uncle still lives here, so we would always go to like Mardi Gras, Jazz Fest, and stuff. So I have like a lot of really great childhood memories. And then when we first started touring, I have some really awesome like touring memories here too.
Well, so, when you guys were first touring, that was probably right around, like, right post Katrina.
Yeah. I mean, the whole city has completely changed, too, because I remember you walking around and, like, you know, entire blocks would just be, like, you know, all the buildings would be closed up. It was wild. And I remember my aunt and uncle, they were just telling me, they're like, they really just didn't know if it would ever come back, because it just took years and years to, you know, to revitalize. So, I mean, I guess I don't know as much about what's going on with the city, but from the looks of it, it seems that everything is it's doing a lot better than obviously it was.
No, I like New Orleans a lot too. I think a lot of bands, like some of the perspective we have of places is how like people's opinions on cities is how annoying it is as a band to be
very
in,
true,
or how like successful you are. Like people love Cologne, Germany because shows are so good there. You
absolutely
know
what I
mean? New Orleans, yep. Not exactly like a hotbed of you know, of pop punk rock, you know,
totally. And so then
it gives the city like a different vibe because people go there and it's like, oh well, we only had like 200 kids at our show or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's like an interesting thing that happens with what we do.
Absolutely, yeah, and that totally changes everything. And I think that's why, like, you know, it's hard to get a show here just because, like you said, there's not as much of a scene. But like, you know, when you can take an off day here, it's amazing. You know, like the rest of the guys, they all went on a cemetery tour today.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, it's just like cool stuff like that. There's a bunch of good restaurants we're all planning on going to and stuff. So, yeah, it's just, you know how it is. Like when you have an off day and you're at a hotel on off of the side of the highway, yeah, and there's literally nothing to do besides, you know, eat Jimmy John's or something like that, it just sucks. But like when you're in a really amazing city, it makes for a great off day.
No, totally. I'm right on board with you there, man. So you're on tour with Tiger's Jaw and Culture Abuse, and you're heading now from west to east.
Yeah.
And you're halfway through. How's it been?
It's been amazing. It's been crazy, actually. The shows have all, you know, they're like all selling out. They're packed out. It's been a dream tour. Everybody's been so fun to be around. And we're playing, you know, kind of playing a lot of our favorite clubs. It's a new album tour, so it's super fun to be able to play new songs every night.
Right.
You know, it's a 6-week tour, which none of us actually realized was that long until like a month beforehand. But, you know, it doesn't even seem that long. Like I don't know. It's wild. Like 3 weeks have gone by and it feels like it's a week. We're a week in. So
yeah,
that's kind of like the best thing when that happens. So,
well, the end of the tour will certainly drag. That's,
that's how it always goes, right? It goes.
So the new record is out. Hello Exile. It's been out for what? Like a month, a little over a month.
Yeah.
And, I mean, going back out on tour, I always wonder, you know, I have a take on it and I've heard other people's take on it. It's like, it's hard to know how much of the new stuff to play.
Absolutely.
And like you guys have so much material now, and you're, especially since you're coming off a record that was so successful and so well loved and so many people found out about you on that album, you kind of have to play those songs, I think.
Totally.
Right? So it's like really hard because a lot of times it's like, okay, we aren't going to play that much from like the last album because we just did that album tour. Uh-huh. So now we're switching it up and playing new stuff. But I feel like it must be a hard thing for you to navigate.
Absolutely. And I think this, like, it's crazy because, you know, there's like the set staple kind of songs that I feel like we have to play. You know, if we like showed up somewhere and didn't play Good Things, people would be like pretty pissed off, you know?
Right.
So that's kind of been one of those things of just being like, how many new songs to play. So I think we're doing anywhere from like 6 to 8 per night. We've kind of been switching it up. We kind of like wanted to rotate songs in and out.
Cool.
And it's the first tour too that we're doing like an hour and a half set. Typically we kind of always done like an hour 10, hour 15. So
yeah,
we just bought ourselves a little bit extra time and, kind of going for it on that end. So
yeah, it's amazing how much longer an hour and a half is than an hour and 10 though. Like it's only 20 minutes. It's only like, you know, maybe 6 songs or something like that, but
yeah,
it ends up being like crazy longer. It feels longer. And then there's also weird, like, I feel like the crowd, you kind of need to plan, like you can't really just go at them like as hard as you can for an hour and a half. You have to plan out like some kind of a little lull in the set.
Absolutely.
You know, how has that been? Because you guys aren't typically a band that does that, right?
Yeah, so that's kind of like been one of the bigger changes that, you know, it's pretty exciting for us to do, is it was kind of always been a band where we're just going to fire on 10 the entire set,
yeah,
you know? And we were like, well, you know, we're kind of, you know, our songwriting is kind of changing. The dynamic of what we want to be as a band is kind of changing from that aspect. And we kind of wanted to, you know, have parts of the set that are, you know, slower. And, you know, we having like an acoustic block in the middle,
right,
towards the end of the set, you know, when people are like generally pretty tired and they're done crowd surfing, you know, just have something to chill out on. And, so that's been like super fun for us to have a bit more dynamic of a set than, you know, just the, let's just kill them with, you know, sing-alongs kind of stuff.
Totally. Well, you know, being like a, you know, a punk rock band and coming from punk rock where, you know, some of your songs are shorter and, you know, you got to play a lot of them, but also your fans have gotten older.
Yeah.
And you talk a lot about this in your songs about you getting older, but your fans, I feel, have grown with you. And
Absolutely.
Now you have a lot of fans that are in their 30s. Maybe, I don't know about a majority, but I feel like you do have a bit of an older fan base.
Yeah.
And is it important for you guys to really give them a good show when, like, so much of the time this is like they've got a babysitter, or like they got to get up early for work and they're making a sacrifice or something to see your band play? You know, you're giving them that extra. Is that kind of part of the thinking?
Yeah, totally. And that's a big part of it too. We actually talk about it a lot because for so long we kind of judged the show based on like, all right, was there a lot of crowd surfers? Was there,
right.
you know, how was like, was there a big pit the whole show? Like stuff right. like that. And, you know, now we're like, wow, you know, I'm 31, the other guys are 33. And we're like, when we go to shows, we stand in the back and watch the bands. And you're like, the majority of our fans are those kind of people now too. You know, they've kind of transitioned from like, I'm going to be right up front singing along, you know? So we're kind of like, you know, we don't need to write a set list where we're just constantly, you know, catering to like, to have, you know, people stage diving the entire time. So it's like, we definitely want to have like, you know, a more dynamic set, a longer set, things that are just, you know, different from time to time, because it's, you know, like you said, our fan base has really grown with us and they continue to come out to our shows year after year, but we want to make sure that they feel different and they feel, you know, it's something that they want to continue to keep seeing and supporting. So we try to, you know, just switch it up but just still be like honest and just do what we've always done. So, yeah.
Yeah, man, totally, totally. So I want to talk a little bit about your upbringing and your origins, if you don't
cool.
mind.
Of course.
Scranton, Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a cool place, like, well, not really a cool place, but it's an interesting place because it's very close to a lot of things,
yep.
but probably too far away when you're a kid to, like, really go to New York City to see a show. Like, maybe
yeah, sure.
Philadelphia, you'd go all the time, but I kind of wonder what it was like growing up there. You know, I know you met like most of your band, I think, when you were in high school.
Yeah.
So how did that kind of dynamic work and what was it like for you? I just picture a bunch of punks like fucking shit up. Is that accurate?
Yeah. More or less. So basically, the three guys, Tom, Eric, and Joe, they all went to the same high school. They lived in Scranton and I lived in a tiny town outside of Scranton, called Lake Ariel. So I went to a different high school than them. And yeah, I went to a different high school than them. And, you know, the punk scene was just so small. But it was like very, you know, it was very vibrant still, you know, touring bands would come through and they would play in Wilkes-Barre and there would always be 200 people like packed out of, you know, kids from the ages of like 15 to 22 or, you know, just really young and, supportive. So, I kind of met everybody through that scene. I started, some bands in high school, you know, just kind of fun stuff. And then, you know, when those bands broke up, and the other guys' bands broke up. That's kind of, I was senior in high school, and that's kind of when we started the Menzingers, which is, I always like think back and realize how funny it is that I'm still in my high school band. It's like,
yeah.
It's pretty ridiculous.
Well, you know what? I am too, technically.
Yeah, nice.
Because I started, Silverstein was started when I was 19. I was in my last year of high school too.
That's amazing.
We have an extra year in Canada. We have an extra year of high school.
Okay.
I didn't fail or anything.
Yeah.
No, it is funny, right? And like,
yeah.
And you've been trucking along the whole time and now you're in your 30s and it's funny, right? Because how much you've probably grown up with these people.
Of course.
You know,
yeah.
And like you think back to when you were in high school and you were just not really, no one really knew anything. And now you've figured it out all together. That's kind of
totally.
A beautiful story.
Yeah. It's, you know, we've been so fortunate to go through this journey, just the four of us, together. Like, you know, we've learned so much, you know, just from doing this since I was 17, you know?
Yeah.
And yeah, and, you know, I think that there's like Scranton was really cool, to start music. Cause well, it had a lot of beneficial things and it had a lot of negative things about it. So the negative things were kind of the obvious that it was so insular, you know, like mm-hmm. It was hard for us to kind of break out of just like, you know, playing in Scranton, like, you know, getting into Philly, getting like playing, getting shows in New York, like that was really difficult because it was all about who you knew, you know? And, we didn't really know anybody in those cities. We would try to get on shows, but, for a long time, it just didn't really work. But on the flip side of that is that we had like this amazing music scene in Scranton. That was like, you know, when Title Fight were starting, and
right.
Tiger's Jaw, and we had a bunch of our other friends' bands, and like there's all these kids that were like so involved and doing so much cool stuff. So we had our own thing, but it was kind of like no one else was paying attention to it. And yeah, that was kind of our decision, where we knew that we wanted to be a band full time, but it just wasn't working for us in Scranton. So that's when we moved to Philly and, you know, started making a lot of friends in the music industry. And it's funny because by the time we moved to Philly, then everybody started paying attention to all these Scranton bands.
But, it's always the way it works.
So, right. Yeah. So, but yeah, that was, so then we kind of moved to Philly in 2008. And that's kind of, you know, it's kind of where the band's home base is essentially, just because we weren't really doing that much in Scranton. We couldn't get on tours, you know, right. We would that kind of stuff. So
yeah, it's amazing that matters. I guess it matters. It probably matters less now than it
definitely
did 10, 11, 12 years ago, whatever it is. Because just now everything is so on the internet and no one really cares where anyone's from. And like
no.
Scenes are kind of like, I always say, like, you hear a band and you're like, oh, it's a cool band. And like, you used to be able to kind of tell where they were from, like if they were
sure.
a West Coast band or an East Coast band. Now it's like, oh, they're probably just from like Ohio or something.
Yeah. Like, yeah. That's so true. It's like, bands could, you know, like in 2005, you had to like kind of do it the old school way of like, you go on tour and tour and you gain your fan base from like touring. And that's kind of how mm-hmm. we, you know, realized that was the only way that was going to work for us, where now it's like, you know, you can just put out an album and then online overnight, it can be an online sensation and you can go on tour and have a sold out tour, which is just like, you know, so nuts to us that would even be possible.
It's like so nuts. Like, that band I Prevail, I'm friends with uh-huh. them. And great kids. Yeah, their first show ever was sold out at the Crowfoot in Pontiac, Michigan.
Like, that's insane.
Yeah, yeah. Like, they just, but like, I mean, I laugh and I shake my head, but like, in a way, like, I never want to be that like old jaded dude that
sure.
says like, oh, I think like I paid my fucking dues, like I'm better than you. Cause I think that, you know, this shit evolves and good for younger people for figuring it out.
Yeah,
but that blows my mind, man. Just
it really does.
You make bands are making videos before they ever play shows. That's so backwards.
Totally. And as long as the band has their head on the right shoulders, you know, and they're doing it for the right reasons, like no one should have to like grind it out like all of our bands that are around our age did, you know, like doing house show tours for no money and, you know,
yeah,
like,
but it
just
was fun though,
stuff.
Man. But
it
was fun.
Yeah, you're right.
Like selling, like there's a video we're doing our 20 year anniversary next year, and we're looking at old photos and stuff because we're talking about like maybe doing like some kind of a book or like something like
that. Oh, cool.
And there's a photo from one of our first tours of me selling t-shirts on grass, like on the lawn outside a house show in a front, like using a flashlight to sell merch to like just so I can make $12 to sell a
yeah,
shirt
sure.
to somebody just so $12 in the gas tank. Like that stuff is so funny, you know?
Yeah, it is really great. And you know, you definitely there's things about that aspect of our touring career that I just you'll never be able to get back because, you know, things have changed so much, you know. It's like, I mean, I don't even think I've gone to a house show in 5 or 6 years. You know, it's just like that kind of stuff. Just, you know, it's off of my radar. I guess I'm old now. It's like, you know,
true.
It's like it's for another generation. And, you know, I don't even think our fans would want to see us in a house, even if we did play it. They'd be like, this sounds like shit. You know?
I know. How does a full band move work? Like, you guys are adults with like shit going on and people have girlfriends and like whatever different financial situations.
Sure.
So all of a sudden to be like, hey guys, we're moving to Philadelphia. Like that's, I mean, I know it's still in the same state. It's not like on the other side of the country or a different country, but I still wonder how that works. And I'm weird about the technical side of things. So I just wonder how that worked.
Yeah, it was a crazy time. So I was transferring schools again. So I initially went to Temple in Philadelphia, and you know, I only did a semester. I was like, it was too hard to do the band in Scranton and to be there. And I was like, the band is more important to me than school, but I still wanted to go to school. So then I kind of transferred back to a school in Scranton, and I did a year and a half. And then, I was at a crossroads where I had to finish my degree, but, there was nowhere in Scranton that I could do it. So okay. I transferred back to Philly. So for me, I was just like, I need to go back to Philly to finish this. You know, I think, you know, we need to make a decision here of like, we either need to move to New York or we need to move to Philly. And I want to kind of figure out how I can, you know, continue to finish my degree and do the band. And you know, I think our first choice was that we all wanted to move to Brooklyn, and we just looked into it and it was completely impossible. Like there was absolutely no way that we could do it. And, so, you know, when we started thinking about it more, Philly became the real, you know, the only viable place that we could afford to live. So, you know, me and Tom decided to move first, and then, Eric and Joe moved like a month later, and, we had a house together and we all lived together. And then like, you know, we just kind of figured it out somehow. I don't know. And it was kind of cool because then, like, we would go on tour when we all lived together. We would just be like, all right, well, we'll just pay all the bills that we make from tour.
Wow.
So we can live together. And, you know, I think a lot, we would tell bands that we all live together, they would be like, how could you go on tour and then come home together? And I don't know. It's just like, that's just kind of who we are, though. It's like, even when we go home from tour, it's like they're the first people that I call to hang out with, you know, the next day. It's like, it's pretty wild.
That is wild. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's funny. Cause you know, my band has had a longevity with the same members for the most part. We've only had one member mm-hmm. change in 20 years. And, people always ask me like, oh, what's your secret? You know, like, and they mm-hmm. probably ask you that too.
Sure.
And we have absolutely opposite answers. Like my answer is, well, I don't like when we go home, I don't really see them that much. Like we're sure. friends and stuff, but we're not like best friends. Like
gotcha.
We see each other but like definitely don't live together. Definitely yep. don't like the first person I call, like, hey man, want to get a drink? And it's like,
yeah.
last night we were in Europe getting a drink and now we're in Philadelphia getting a drink or whatever.
Yeah.
That's just like so crazy to me. Cause I don't know how, you're not sick of these people.
I don't know how I'm not either. I don't know, man. It's crazy. You know, like I think that we're all really honest with each other and we all pick on each other a lot, but right. like in a good, honest way. And we know what, like we know to respect each other's boundaries, you know, and, you know, it's been a long learning process of how to deal with, you know, you become family. So it's like, you know, I know things that I'm not, if something gets on my nerves, I know to be like, hey, don't dive into this. Don't make fun of somebody. You know, this is like, you know, you don't have to be mean to them, like be nice, you know? Mm-hmm. And, we've just kind of like always kind of stuck with that. And, you know, if something is really troubling us, you know, we're really open with our communication. We'll just like kind of talk about why something bothers us. And I don't know, it just kind of works because we all just respect each other's opinions and each other. And, and, you know, yeah, I mean, we definitely, you know, you definitely have your ups and downs, of course,
sure.
but, you know, yeah. And, yeah, we've just been super lucky with that. It's been amazing.
So, what were you studying in school?
I went to school for political science.
Okay.
I had a dream of opening a political science store downtown. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah, I don't really, you know, it was one of those things. I just always knew that I wanted to be in a band, but in the back of my mind, I really did want to go to school and kind of do the whole thing and have that experience. And I've always loved politics, and I wanted to learn more about it. And I didn't know what I was going to do. I was like, hopefully the band takes off. If not, you know, I always had in the back of my mind, maybe I'd go to law school or do something, you know, work for a nonprofit, figure something out. But, yeah, I just, you know, became so fortunate that like the day that I graduated, we went on tour. It was wild. And then I had my graduation party in the middle of this tour that we were on, which was, it was really fun. So we like routed a couple days off, went back home cool. and got like a keg in the backyard and then went back on tour. So, yeah, I just kind of got lucky that like the whole the whole thing just kind of took off right when I graduated, and I didn't have to have like, all right, well, I got to find the real job and make this work and back and forth.
Yeah, it is interesting. And do you ever think you're going to use that degree now? I mean, like it's, you know, I mean, your success has just stayed. Your band seems to have a lot of staying power. And,
sure.
You know, people always used to say to me, and like, I want to ask you about your parents in a second, but like mm-hmm. People are always like, well, what are you going to do after this? Like,
sure.
Or this isn't going to last forever. And it's like, well, you know what? It might.
Like,
in some capacity, like whether it's, you know, you end up, you know, as the band ends up breaking up and you do another band or you do something mm-hmm. by yourself or you end up producing records or working, you know, somewhere behind the scenes in music, like
sure.
None of that requires a degree, you know,
no,
the degree of the road, I guess.
Yeah. And I don't think people realize how much you learn about the music industry when you're involved in it from an artist like perspective. There's so many career paths that like, you know, are they're definitely difficult to get into if you're not in it, you know, but like, kind of like you said, like from anywhere from producing to like guitar teching, like, you know, managing, booking, like there's so many different career paths in music. You know, I don't know. I really don't. I try not, like, I used to think about it a lot, mainly when the band like wasn't financially successful and it was pretty hard and there wasn't necessarily the avenue over like, are we all going to just continue to do this even though we're not making any money? You know, we're all living together. Like, you know, this is pretty hard. But now it's just like, yeah, the band has been really successful, and it's, what's really cool is it brings so much happiness to so many people that across the world. It's like, it's unbelievable, seriously. So, I think the dream would be not to have to use the degree to continue to do this. Like, you know, it's nice knowing that there's some kind of backup that like, if I ever wanted to go to school again, I can, you know, add to that. But like, I don't know. I love songwriting so much and I love performing music and writing music and like just and being in this band that like, I guess the dream is that it doesn't have to end.
That's right. Are your parents super stoked you got your degree figured out and everything? And
yeah.
Like, did you kind of like win them over now? Like, okay. Because I went to school for 3 years and I never ended up getting my degree. And I think my parents are still like fine with it, but mm-hmm. I think a part of them was like, oh, well, because when we started touring, I did some like classes, you know, like
sure.
correspondence or online or whatever you did at the time. And, I never got my degree though. So,
sure.
So yeah. How is your relationship with your parents and your family? Do you have brothers and sisters or anything?
Yeah, I have a younger brother, and yeah, my relationship with my parents are great. It's funny because they were definitely a very big deciding factor of like, you need to go to school. You need to go to school. And they were drilling it in me. There wasn't really an option. Like, you know, I could have just said, no, I'm not going, but it would have been, you know, I agreed with them that I knew that I had to, and that I really wanted to, but also like, I was like, I want to do this music thing more, but the music thing really wasn't necessarily ready yet. We were still kind of like figuring that part out. So, yeah, they were definitely really pushing me to do it. And what's funny though, is that like after I graduated in the band kind of just, we really just took off. Like they love the band now. they kind of realized that like going to shows is super fun. There's a bunch of booze backstage. You get to like hang out and like there's all these different people they get to meet at shows. Like my dad has seen us, like it's crazy. He's seen us in like LA and like London. Like he flies everywhere. Like, and so they're like crazy supportive of the band. And that's what's really cool is that all of our families are all like, you know, really, really supportive. Like Eric's parents were like the OG supporters, you know, like, we practiced in his basement, you know, you know, they wear their t-shirts everywhere. They're like, you know, they've always been so supportive of the band. Tom's parents, Joe's parents. It's like, it's a really, really cool thing to have that, you know.
I think you need that. Like if it wasn't for like my dad helping me out, like I traded my car in and then my dad helped me out with a little bit more money so we could get a van.
Sure.
You know? And yeah, like we practiced in Josh's parents' basement and then my parents actually even did our merch, like our merch store
awesome.
When we were on tour, you know, in the early days. So yeah, you need that, you know,
I
think most, almost every band does. A really funny story was this band called Somehow Hollow that used to be on Victory Records, we toured with. He said that the singer of that band said one time he was ordered like a shirt from like the MXPX like web store or something.
Uh-huh.
And he got a phone call, and it was Mike Herrera's mom being like, hey, we don't have that in a large. Is a medium okay? And he's like, sure.
Just, that's incredible.
Yeah, and like this, at this point, this was like MXPX was a really big deal. You know?
Sure,
so
yeah.
It's funny how so many people don't realize behind the scenes, bands need help from their families to make this happen.
Totally, totally. And like you said, with like the vehicle thing, we're in the same kind of boat of like Eric's parents, his dad's a mechanic and like just would do all the work for free on the van. And like, you know, we're buying like cheap vans, so they're always breaking down and stuff. Like, that's huge. Like, I mean, that's like every band's nightmares to be traveling and then have their van blow up. So like things like that of having them help us purchase vans, like always fixing it and just like all the support. Yeah, it's huge. We definitely, without like the community that's kind of supported this band, like our family and our really close-knit friends, like we wouldn't have been anywhere, you know. And I think that goes the same as like every successful band, you know, just having a really strong support structure behind you is like really, really crucial.
Definitely. So you have two singers in the band. Which one of you or Tom has lead singer syndrome more than the other?
It's a very interesting question because I would say we both suffer from it in different ways at different times. You know, like there's things that I get really cranky about, and there's things that Tom gets cranky about. Like the thing though is that like we're such a insane democracy that we kind of don't really have the one person which is like, well, it's got to be his way because that's how it goes. Like, we're, you know, like we just never like. The rhythm sections never let that fly, you know, and rightfully so. So, you know, I would say that Tom has his moments and I definitely have my moments, but I guess we're pretty equal.
Very diplomatic answer. Good job.
Yes.
But having two singers in a band is like a bit unique. You guys,
sure.
I don't know how much you guys split the vocal duties. In fact, I don't always know who's singing on some of the songs. I'm sure that happens. Like,
yeah, a lot of people tell us that.
Yeah, it's weird. I like feel like I should know, and then I have to like kind of think about it in my head.
Yeah.
But how does it work with writing like that? Do you guys write together? Do you write separately? Bring your songs in?
It's crazy. People ask us this question a lot, and I wish that I had like a better concrete answer because it always changes for us. I would say so. We always, when we start writing an album, it's always the four of us in a room writing it, you know, and that's how we've done every single album. How we get there and how we get the songs has kind of always been a little, you know, every song kind of takes its own path. I would say the majority of the times it's Tom or I coming in with a melody, a verse, or a chorus, something to guide where the direction of the practice is going to go. And then the four of us kind of jam out the arrangement and the music behind it and kind of form it that way. I would say typically, like, you know, for most of the time, if I'm singing a song, I'll kind of write all the lyrics and the melody. And if Tom's singing a song, he'll write the lyrics and the melody. That's not always totally true. Like, we've definitely kind of shared melodies, shared lyrics before, but I would say almost all the time, that's kind of the case. And yeah, it's kind of like, you know, I would say on this last album, Hello Exile, it was pretty typical where, I would go in to practice and be like, hey, I got this, I got a verse and a chorus, you know, here it is. And we would kind of jam on it. And then what that would happen at that practice, I would go home at night and kind of rewrite my melodies and lyrics to kind of fit what we're working on. Go in again the next day, do that whole thing, take it home at night, edit it again, and then go back and kind of, that was like the most successful structure that we've had in a long time.
No, definitely. And working with Will Yip, I know you've talked about how he's kind of a geek for songwriting.
Yeah.
And how he kind of fits you guys as a producer so well. Does he have interesting takes like that ever where it's like, hey, I know you wrote this song, Greg, and it means a lot to you, but maybe Tom would sound better singing this song. Like, does that ever happen?
You know, that never did happen, but it would be totally cool if it did happen. Yeah. I'd be totally open to it, you know. I think a lot of times with Will, you know, he is like a total geek, a songwriting geek, you know, much like I am. And that's kind of the beauty of working with him, of just getting down to it and like looking at seeing what works, being like, hey, you know, what is the idea of the bridge? It's to build, you know, what are we trying to get here? And then realizing that what we have might not work, you know. And what's really cool too is I think as singers, and me and Tom definitely fall into this category of that, you get really comfortable in your melodic choices. And like, you know, you kind of tend to sing things a certain way, and, you know, your verses tend to sound a certain way. It's like, you know, that's how you just always have done it. And what's really cool about Will is he tries to break us out of that sometimes. And, you know, he has much more of an ear for like, he loves like pop music, you know. He was in Lauryn Hill's band, so you know. And so he has, so when he comes, when he's like, hey, I got this idea for a melody for an outro, and I'll just start humming something, and then I'll just go, oh, it'll click, you know. And then all of a sudden I could put the words and I can finish the melody of what he was working on. And it's different than like, say, me and Tom going back and forth on that, because we've kind of both have been doing that for years and years now, you know. And having somebody else in there kind of breaking us out of what we're comfortable with is totally. It's been really awesome for us.
Totally. Well, I love that though. But I also think producers have that too. Like everybody has their own thing. So, you know what I mean? If you can bring a producer that their, you know, melodic brain, the way that their melodic brain works, and the way that your melodic brain works, if they can work in different ways, you know, but work together, that's the best.
For sure. I found that's the best with songwriting is having the best, like, I always think the best songs always come from, you know, having a lot of interpretation in it. Like, at least in our respect, like, you know, like if I was going to try to write a song completely on my own, I feel like it's never going to be as good as having like a bunch of hands in there. And I know a lot of people don't like that, and they like, no, this is how it goes. I want the song to be this, mm-hmm. but I just feel like there's so much strength of having other creative minds involved with it.
Cool. That's a very mature take. I like that. I guess having another guy handling a large chunk of the vocals is nice live. You get a little bit of a break.
It's incredible. I always think of like singers, like, you know, like, man, how does like Davey Havoc do it? You know, people that sing like at the top of their lungs, like just so loud, like the screaming shit, like, damn, like,
yeah, dude. Tell me about
God. It. Yeah. Right. I know. Like, how do you do it? Like that kind of stuff. Like, then yeah, even like, what was I thinking about the other? Oh, like, you know, we've toured with Taking Back Sunday a bunch, and like just talking to Adam, because Adam sings so high and for so long, their sets are like 1.5-2 hours.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what do you do to warm up for it? He's just like, oh, I've never done warm ups ever. And I'm like, are you kidding me? How could you have you toured all like 200 days out of the year and you sing these songs? But I don't know, I guess. But yeah, so what I'm getting at is essentially having two singers is amazing for that. Like just being able to write a set list where it's like, all right, I'll sing three songs, Tommy sing three songs, and we'll kind of go back and forth. It's great.
No, it's also probably cool, like, you're a guitar player and being able to focus a little bit on guitar once in a while. Like,
definitely.
I feel like that's something that as a singer I miss. I miss playing guitar. Yeah. But I love just being like, all right, I can just like focus on like actually playing this riff rather than like sort of playing guitar half-assed while I'm trying to hit all the fucking notes. Because that's kind of what singing is when you're playing guitar.
You can never be that good at playing guitar when you're singing, you know, because like you're always focusing on hitting the notes and everything. And that's the part I love, just being able to sit back and play guitar. I feel like I love the opportunity of getting to sing and getting to write lyrics and kind of express myself in that way. It's like one of the greatest gifts that's ever happened to me. But like in another life, I would love to just be a guitar player, no microphone, and just be able to play and not have to sing.
Totally. I think that if I was just a guitar player or a bass player, I'd have a severe alcohol problem though.
Absolutely.
I would say the same
exact thing. Or it was just being like, the only reason that I can't drink a lot before is because I can't drink and sing, you know, but I can drink and play guitar.
I know. Or just like the next day you wake up and like, my voice is gone because I was in the bar yelling. Like, so you can't do those things. And
yep.
it's definitely true. I want to talk a little about a couple of the songs from the new record, if you don't mind, mm-hmm. before I let you go.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I think the first song, America, You're Freaking Me Out, also the first single, it's interesting because I didn't know about your political science background.
Uh-huh.
Because you're not really a political songwriting guy.
No, yeah,
and
definitely.
And to do that, I mean, obviously we're in kind of a critical, very, like, the president is right now potentially getting impeached. So,
yeah.
You know, it's kind of a wild time.
It's a wild time.
Is
sure.
that what kind of compel you to finally kind of break your silence and make a bit of a statement?
Kind of, yeah. You know, like, it's tough because I've always kind of valued, you know, I love political music and I love protest music and folk music, you know, that's always been kind of socially driven in that regard. But I've, to be honest with you, I've always struggled with writing it. It doesn't really come naturally to me, and I'm very in tune with politics. With yeah. you know, I follow every you know, I read the paper every day. I'm pretty up to date with that kind of stuff. But political writing has never really come natural to me, and it's something that I've always wanted to get better at. Every time we write an album, I'm always writing political music, and then I just find out I'm just like, I don't know, I don't like it, you know. And it always ends up feeling very time and a place, but. For this song, right when we were starting the album, I knew that I wanted to write a very standout political track. And that was just one where I was just like, it's okay to just be blatant and obvious here, you know? Like, shit is fucking insane and it's crazy and it's wrong. And, like, you know, I knew that I wanted to say something. It's like the elephant in the room. How could you write an album now and not mention something, you know, not mention politics? So, I think that's kind of... It's just one of those things. And now, you know, what's been really cool is that it's a lot of people have just come up to me and said, like, you know, thanks for that song. You know, I'm kind of feeling the same way. It's like, it's great to have this. And it's kind of lit the spark in me to be like, man, I want to continue to write about things that I care about that aren't just about, like, you know, my life or my family life and stuff like that, you know, outside of that. And I think in the past when I've written about politics, it's kind of been kind of almost in like the more Bruce Springsteen kind of way where you're talking about a story, you know, that is politically, it's a politically different story because life is, you know, surrounded by politics. You know, song like Midwestern States, you know, of kind of, you know, the recession, kind of right. being young and not having an opportunity for jobs and things like that. And it kind of comes off, doesn't really come off political, but in essence, it's political. That's kind of been more the kind of style that I wanted to write in. But for America, You're Freaking Me Out, I just felt like I kind of wanted to just go for it.
Totally, man. Totally.
Yeah.
No, it's great. It's a great, great song. I wonder,
thanks.
Though, has there been any backlash? Like, there's so many people that are like, you're just a singer of the band, like, stay in your lane. Like, do you get that?
I thought there would be so much more backlash, but honestly, absolutely none. I also don't really read, like, YouTube comments and shit like that, because I don't like to torture myself. But you know, I'm sure there is somewhere on the internet people like that kind of stay in your lane, talk about whatever. But I think the thing about the song too is it's not like a song with a bunch of hot takes, you know. I think right. everybody could understand that, like, you know, there's economic injustice that's happening in the country, the whole you know, like everything that I sing about, you know, hiding behind religion, things like that, like they're pretty obvious stuff. Mm-hmm. And I yeah. think no matter where you fall, everybody can agree that shit's wrong in America right now. So I think that kind of saved it.
Absolutely. So we did talk about drinking a little bit. Mm-hmm. And there's the song, I Can't Stop Drinking. I'm not sure how serious the song is. Like, in some ways it's written like, yeah, I seriously have a problem. Like, I'm a functioning alcoholic, but it's also got this, like, kind of like drunk punks, like, kids doing dumb shit in Scranton, like, vibe.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, it's kind of like a song I just wanted to ask you about because it's an interesting one, and it's you know, a ballady song. I don't know, like,
yeah. So it's an interesting one, yeah, for sure. It took me about a year to write it, and that's probably the only song on the album, maybe in like almost, I feel like maybe even our whole career, where it was just like the song, I wrote the song and then we just played it and then it was just like, yeah, it's done. You know, like, yeah. I think it's just that kind of storytelling kind of thing. And yeah, it took me a long time to kind of finesse exactly what I wanted to say. I knew that, you know, I knew that I wanted to write a song about, my own struggles with alcohol, you know, other bandmates' struggles with alcohol, my family, their struggles, my friends. I kind of wanted to just pull a lot of those stories that I've heard, over the last decade of, you know, heavy consumption, as you can say, of being in a traveling band. And I wanted to write the story about it all. And yeah, I think I didn't want to go, you know, I just wanted to be honest with it. And I wanted to tell, I was definitely nervous for people to hear it, because it's pretty revealing. But right. You know, I think that's like, to me, it's like what I like in songs. And you know, I've written a lot about alcohol in the past, and it's usually very, very fun and, you know, kind of like always very joyous kind of celebrations with it. And you know, it's not always like that. And so yeah, that's kind of where it came from. Just you know, I wouldn't say. It's not necessarily my story, but it's like a story of a lot of people around me that kind of all tied into one.
Totally. And London Drugs, were you aware of that being a drugstore in Vancouver?
That is so funny, because I actually didn't. I was reading some book, I forget what it was, and I saw the word London Drugs. It made me think of all the times that I've been in London and England and partying. And then while I was Googling it, I was like, maybe that's a song title. And I Googled it, and it was like, yeah, these drugstores in Canada. Yeah. I was like, oh my God, this is so weird. So like, there's got to be somebody that works at the London Drugs. It's just like, Jesus, man, don't come here then.
That's very funny. Yeah. No, yeah. That's when I saw the track listing and I saw that like first thing I saw was that, I was like, yeah. Oh, like Vancouver. Yeah. you know, it's like the CVS of Vancouver or BC, yeah. or I guess Western, I think it's all of Western Canada, but I've only ever been to it in Vancouver. It's not in Eastern Canada at all.
I couldn't believe that was a thing. It was so funny.
It is funny, man. Okay, well, I'll let you go. I got one more fan question, if you don't mind.
Sure.
And I really do appreciate you doing this.
No, thank you for having me.
The question is, after the party, the record got a lot of heat. It opened a lot of doors for your band. Was it surprising to see so many people finally finding out about you guys 10 years after your first album came out?
It's a really funny question, because it was a little strange just being like, where have you guys been all this time? You know,
right.
But it's amazing, because yeah, like that question said, it's like there was such a turning point for our band. All of a sudden, like, you know, we always did well in like say New York or Chicago, LA, Philly, that kind of stuff. But then all of a sudden now we're like doing well in Omaha, you know, we're doing well in like, you know, just all over the place. And then that was like where we had critical success across the world, where we can go to Australia and do club tours and, you know, going back and forth to Europe and doing that. So it was wild. And still to this day, I think that the way that I kind of always thought that people's like fans' favorite would always be a record on the Impossible Pass when we play those songs. And now it's kind of crazy, because there's some people in the crowd that don't even know those songs. Yeah. And then we play after the party songs and it's like the place goes nuts and they're like, oh wow. So it's pretty wild in that sense where, you know, but I kind of like that. I feel like the band is continuing to grow. And I think that that's going to be kind of our legacy, where we can continue to, you know, write albums that people are going to want to listen to and sing along to.
Absolutely. Great answer. Yeah. Well, Greg, thank you so much for doing this, man. And have a great rest of your tour.
Appreciate it. Thank you so much for having me. This has been awesome.
They keep coming out in droves and supporting this thing.
I hope so too.
And I hope to see you around, man.
Yeah. Sounds great, dude. Thanks again.
I will play a tune for the people. Here it is. America, You're Freaking Me Out on Lead Singer Syndrome. Thanks, Greg.
Thanks again. Take care.
In the streets.
So there it is with the very well-spoken Greg of the Menzingers, the political science major, now finally writing some political songs. It was really awesome having him. What a guy. What a band. Oh, man. And what a song you just heard. The opening track of their brand new record, which is out now. Go pick up that shit on vinyl. I'm sure they pressed it on like four or five different colors. It probably all looks amazing. Pick it up. Next week, we're going to have another great episode. I know I said that at the intro, but I just want to make sure that you know. It's with my friend, Jeremy of The Devil Wears Prada. Yeah, he's a guitar player. He's also a great lead singer. And his voice on the new Devil Wears Prada album really shines. So I wanted to get his take. That's not to be missed. So make sure you're back next Wednesday to check that out. Do we have time for another song? I think we got time for another song. Let's rip one. Here it is, the title track from the last Menzingers record. Here is After the Party on Lead Singer Syndrome. Peace and love. See you next week.